Lurley here on The Lurley Show, and welcome. You know, we've been debating free will versus destiny versus how can we affect our own lives and the lives of the collective gestalt for millennia. Greg Braden offers some new insight into this, called from ancient text and his own experience and observations. He's just come out with his latest book, long-awaited, The Isaiah Effect, Decoding the Lost Science of Prayer and Prophecy. And he joins us tonight to tell us about an ancient text describing multiple futures, a few tips on how we can choose those futures, and observations he's made out in the field of this practice in place. Hello, Greg, and welcome.
Well, hello, Laura Lee. It's a pleasure to join you this evening. It's a joy to be here.
Thank you. Same here. So tell us a little bit about the Isaiah of the Isaiah Scrolls, who you base your work in the Isaiah Effect around. I know you've been on this track for a long, long time, and you must have felt very delighted for a Dead Sea Scroll to suddenly turn up that's saying pretty much what you've been saying for years.
Well, certainly, Laura Lee. You know, the Great Isaiah Scroll is, interestingly enough, it was one of the first of the Dead Sea Scrolls to be discovered in 1946 by the Bedouin children that found these scrolls quite by accident in the caves above the Dead Sea. In addition to all of the scrolls that have been found subsequent to that, we now know there were over 25,000 fragments that were scattered throughout 11 caves around the Dead Sea. It remains that the first few were the most intact. Isaiah was the first of the Old Testament prophets, considered to be the first great prophet. And in the completeness of the Isaiah scroll, the Isaiah text, we are shown insights into an ancient lineage of wisdom, much of which was lost to the West approximately 1,700 years ago, when that information, that wisdom, was edited from our most sacred text during the 4th century edits, the biblical edits of the 4th century. So it's the prophet Isaiah, I believe, in the words of his time, shared these insights to us in a way that perhaps is more complete than many other of the ancient traditions, although other ancient traditions speak of similar topics.
You know, there's a whole category of the brain-mind-body connection and self-help that also talks about visualization.
Precisely.
And so this seems to be a New Age technique as well. Maybe it was discovered in ancient times. Maybe we've rediscovered it today. Why? Because it works. We can focus consciousness to great effect. Do you want to describe exactly what this technique is?
Well, what we're recognizing now, what we're calling the Isaiah effect, is supported very well by new research in quantum physics, quantum science, relating the power of the inner technology of human emotion with the events of our outer world, events, some of them mirrored in the populations and the choices made in mass populations. Some of them are actually mirrored in the events of nature. Weather patterns and seismic activity now are being determined as having direct linear relationships to mass consciousness and human emotion. Well, these are relatively new concepts in terms of quantum science on the one hand. And on the other hand, it appears that many ancient traditions, in the language of their time, 2,500 years ago and before, were attempting to share precisely such insights with us and to take us even one step further, to show us how we may implement these traditions in our lives today. The Isaiah effect is the word we've given to one of those traditions that the ancients said had the power to bring peace to our world, to heal our bodies, and perhaps avert the greatest tragedies ever to face humankind. And it's done through what we today recognize as a lost modality of prayer. And it's this prayer that I'd like to get into and discuss over the hour as we go through this here.
What aspects of quantum physics support this?
Well, what we find is that in the laboratory, under laboratory conditions, certain conditions may be created in the laboratory where matter behaves very differently than it would in our everyday world, where atoms behave differently, where matter merges together or separates or assumes what we would consider to be miraculous states of excitation, if we can use those words. Well, the ancients are very clear that the miraculous is our natural state of being. What they say is it's natural for us to live in a healed state, for our bodies to be vital, for weather patterns to be gentle, and for crops to grow and produce their food. It is a tension that exists in our world that separates us from the miraculous. In the laboratory, quantum science shows that it is a tension that prevents those miraculous examples in the experiments from unfolding. So under laboratory conditions, what we see is that when we create certain conditions, miracles are possible. We consider to be miracles. What we now know is that within our bodies, we create the same conditions.
How does quantum physics describe this tension? What is the scientific terms used, and how do they pinpoint a tension to separate?
Well, the way it's described is, and some of the most fascinating experiments, Laura Lee, are done certainly on the atomic level, where when we create conditions in the laboratory, when we lower the temperatures, for example, of certain elements, beryllium is an element that has been used experimentally because it lends itself to these kinds of experiments. Under certain conditions in the laboratory, beryllium has now been found. One atom of beryllium will be in two separate places in the same instant in time. And we're told that that cannot happen, that matter can only exist in one place at one time. We're also told that two different states of matter, or two different elements of matter, cannot occupy the same place in the same moment of time because it bumps into to itself. And under laboratory conditions, what we found is that is only true some of the time, and there are conditions where we can take up to 16 million beryllium atoms, merge them together into a single unit that is not possible in our normal waking everyday world. So what we know now is the laws of physics appear to be more relative than universal, and that there are conditions where these things change. And it sounds very nebulous, very hypothetical, sometimes to speak about these things. What makes them very real in our lives is when we apply these understandings to the technology within our body and understand that our bodies can do the same thing that we see done in the laboratories, and the effects, rather than being held in the laboratory, are seen in the world around us. This is one of the keys to understanding the insights into the Essene understandings. The Essenes, the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, are very clear when they say that the world around us is a mirror of the events unfolding within our bodies, of our belief systems, of our consciousness. And from that perspective, we can look to the events around us. We can look to the extremes of weather patterns, for example. We can look to extremes in seismic activity and use those as barometers to gauge changes that are occurring within mass populations of human experience. It's a very different way of looking at things, certainly. And now science is bearing out these relationships, offering us new insight into how we may participate as in determining how these events unfold in our lives.
Now, you've traced back some of the key words used in the Isaiah text back to their original language to understand them better.
Right.
What have you been able to trace back and tell us about the language in which Isaiah, the Old Testament prophet, put this concept in?
Well, in the book, The Isaiah Effect, I chose the Isaiah scroll because of its completeness. And clearly what we did with the Isaiah scroll, I could have approached from a Buddhist tradition or Native American or Mayan tradition.
This is a widespread understanding.
Precisely. It was so concise and so complete. What Isaiah says is, he says, as we embody a state of consciousness, not a thought process, this is based in human feeling, in human emotion, as we embody a state of consciousness based in peace within, that is what opens the doors to the great possibilities of the miracles in our outer world. And this then ties back to the conversation that we just had. The state of peace is what quantum science is creating in the laboratory to create the conditions, to provide the conditions where matter begins to behave differently. So as we create this state of peace in our bodies, now our own research is showing that it has a linear, measurable effect on the world around us, and it is based in what we call an inner technology, Laura Lee. It's It is, in a very real sense, a technology based on the three separate, although related, components of human thought,
mm-hmm.
human emotion, and human feeling. Each of those is a power unto itself, and as those are merged together in union, and the ancient texts say when the three become one, that's when we say to the mountain, mountain, move, and the mountain moves. It's when we merge thought, feeling, and emotion into a focused consciousness of peace in our bodies that heals the tension that stands between us and the miraculous events of our lives.
Okay, question.
We'll get some case histories of that as we go along here.
Okay, question. When you take some beryllium atoms and you slow things down, take away the heat,
right.
reduce the temperature, that takes away the tension or the heat or the excitation of the atoms, and therefore things can behave differently.
Under laboratory conditions. Right.
And you're likening this to a sense of peace in human emotion. When you take away the excitation, the distraction, the self-talk, all this stuff, you're likening that to just taking things down to a very, very quiet level.
Precisely. It's okay. down to essentially a zero state of excitation. It's without judgment in our bodies, without the expectations of right, wrong, or good or bad. So we're saying in the physics world, a lower state of energy represents a form of peace, and our bodies, a quality of thought, feeling, and emotion focused in our hearts represents a state of peace. In the physics world, in that peace, miracles happen. And in our bodies, what we now know, we have machines to measure and document this, in our bodies, when we find that level of consciousness in our bodies, not only do miraculous events occur within our body, the effects are felt beyond our bodies, sometimes miles away.
So in the Hindu tradition, they have mantras that are supposed to quiet the mind. In the Buddhist tradition, the recitation of prayers can quiet the mind. What do you suppose the Essenes did to quiet the mind?
Laura Lee, this is so interesting, and I'm excuse me, you and I had not spoken about this earlier, and I'm very glad that you brought this up. In November of 98, I had the opportunity to facilitate a pilgrimage for 22 days into the highlands of central Tibet, where the records very clearly show that many of the Essene traditions were carried after the first century for safekeeping when they were being persecuted after the crucifixion. And my sense was that it was in these monasteries where we may find some of the most intact records, number one. And number two, perhaps the monks and the nuns are still using these traditions, and we could actually question them about the experience rather than guessing and estimating what their texts were saying to us. And this is precisely the crux, the question that you've asked, of what they were saying. Well, I would ask time and time again, the monks and the nuns and the abbots and the monasteries, I said, through our translators, of course, I said, when we witness you in your chanting halls and you are toning and praying and your mudras and your mantras and the bells and the bowls, and the gongs for 12 and 14 hours a day, when we see that prayer on the outside, I said, what's happening with you on the inside? And time again, they said the same thing. They smiled and they said, you know, you have never seen our prayer because our prayer has no outward expression. Our prayer has no words. What you have seen is what we do in our culture to get to the feeling, and the feeling is the prayer. And then they turned the question around on me. They said, how do you do it in your culture? And it was interesting because I had to think back. In our culture, beginning after the edits of the 4th century, we lost this relationship to feeling. We began to believe that the words were actually the prayers, when in reality, in this mode of prayer, the words are simply designed to get us to the feeling, where the feeling becomes the prayer. So from this perspective, prayer has no outward expression. Prayer is a consciousness that we become rather than something that we do upon occasion.
You know, that's a key distinction, because we tend towards the abracadabra mode. We think that saying a word is the magic that's going to impart the effect. I mean, we have an old tradition about that. You know, in the beginning there was the Word and the Word of God. And so you're saying something very different, that it's actually the experience, the consciousness, the feeling. It focuses on the feeling of it. How did we lose that?
Well, the power of human feeling and human emotion, Laura Lee, appears that maybe not every single person on every street corner understood this, And prior to the Evetts of the 4th century, 1,700 years ago, it appears that this was much more widely understood. There was much more of an acceptance of the role of human feeling and human emotion in what we now recognize as a technology that exists within our bodies. When, during the 4th century, in an attempt to make our biblical texts more accessible, there was a recommendation from the church that at least 25 books be removed from what would later become the Western Bible, and the remaining texts were condensed and rearranged, making that text more accessible to the public at large. And I believe they were successful in doing that. The biblical text, our Bible, did in fact become more readable and more accessible on the one hand. On the other hand, I believe, and I've looked through some of the letters that were actually written by the individuals who were on this panel during the time of Constantine. These are preserved in some of the Roman libraries. And it appears that the members of the council may not have even realized the implications of what they had done. They may not have realized that they took some of the key elements that allow us to feel one with creation and to relate to one another and to the cosmos. They may not have realized that. So I believe initially it was done perhaps without understanding the implications. Now, at later times, I think any time between the 4th century and now, 2,000 years later, those texts could have been reincorporated to round out our understanding of our relationship to the cosmos, and it has not been done. But when that happened, that is when we began to feel separate from our world. We became a very logic-based society, which isn't good or bad unto itself. It's led us on this circuitous path to the point where we are now. We have this tremendously sophisticated technological society on the one hand, and on the other hand, almost universally, scientists and researchers are suggesting that we are approaching a time in human history when our technology may fail us, as we are presented with perhaps the greatest challenges ever to face humankind. Researchers are suggesting, many scientists at the close of the millennium, for example, suggested that an epidemic proportion of a new virus within the next 10 to 12 years, they expect, may wipe out as much as two-thirds of the world's population. We don't know what to do about that. Our science doesn't know how to address that. Many military strategists believe we're barreling down the path toward a third world war as localized conflicts become polarized in regional conflicts. Well, all of these clearly are possibilities, and they are only one of many possibilities as we recognize that we all play a role in determining which of these comes to bear upon our world, which one plays out and which one does not. The role of human feeling and human emotion will be key in making that determination.
What are a couple questions about emotion? Emotions have been misunderstood, mistrusted. They've been relegated to second class. You know, you associate women in hysteria and don't be emotional, stiff upper lip. I mean, we've grown up in a culture for the rise of Western science where the intellect reigned supreme and emotions were relegated into the trash heap pretty much. But
isn't it interesting how it's worked and where it's led us today?
We've spent a lot of time in New Mexico. New Mexico is the state in which you live, and one of the recreated kivas that you can stop at as a monument to the Anasazi people who left them there. I forget where it is, a Cortez, I think, somewhere. Anyway, you go inside there, and they've rebuilt up the kiva, and they've painted pretty much what was there on the kiva walls for ceremony. And Paul and I sat in there one day on one of our trips, and we just watched. I was just watching the pictures, and Paul wanted to sit and soak it all up. And I'm looking at these pictures around, and they're all about the rain. I'm going, oh, duh, they're calling the rain. And then I find out that later on, at some point, the Anasazi were subjected to extended drought. So, of course, they would want to call the rain because They had to. So I'm thinking, gosh, they're showing in all of these pictures rain just pouring down, abundance of rain, you know, going out and splashing and playing in the rain and on these walls. I'm thinking, okay, relating to what you're saying, Greg, this is then kind of a place to perform a prayer, put some pictures on the walls that invoke what it feels like to have all of this wonderful rain falling down in abundance. That would help if you want to feel the emotion of just soaking up the rain. If they're going to call the rain, then picture the rain falling down in abundance. Have you gone to some of the native elders that you know and asked them about the rain dance and what actually they're doing? Are they imagining the rain falling down and joyfully accepting it? Is that part of the rain dance prayer?
It certainly is. And now, you know, for so long, I grew up in a culture that essentially ridiculed something like a rain dance because it made no sense in the language of Western science. The reason it made no sense is because when those edits were made 1,700 years ago, we forgot about that relationship, about the connection, the link, now the digitally measurable link, between human emotion, which is a field effect, and the elements in the world around us. And in the new book, The Isaiah Effect, there's a story, to make a long story very brief, here on the program, and I go to it certainly in more
detail.
It's
a delightful story, bringing the rain to save Machu Picchu. Tell us that story.
Well, there are actually two of them. One of them is in the Pueblos of northern New Mexico, where a Native American friend of mine invited me during a drought in the early 90s to join him in a prayer of rain. And I met him, and we went to a place where his ancestors had gone for thousands of years. Just he and I were there alone. I was not prepared for what I saw him do because I had an expectation of what I believed I would see. And one of the first things he did, Laura Lee, was he gave thanks for the drought that had been. He said, this has been our path. This has been our medicine up until now. And he gave thanks. And in giving the thanks, that is how he released that possibility without judging it. If he were angry at it, that's what would hold it there.
Oh, that makes sense.
And the next thing he did was he stepped into this very ancient circle. He removed his shoes, stepped into the circle. He honored all those who had been there before him, all of his ancestors. And he turned his back to me, assumed a prayer position, his prayer mudra, in front of his heart. And in a few seconds, he turned around. I was very surprised. He looked at me and said, I'm hungry. Why don't we get a bite to eat? And I said, I thought we came here to pray for rain. And this was so key. He looked at me and he said, no. He says, if we prayed for rain, rain could never happen. Because the moment we pray for something to occur, we're acknowledging that in that moment it does not exist. And I said, well, tell me about your prayer. What did I just see you do? And this is where he said, when I closed my eyes, he says, I felt the feeling of what it feels like when I stand with my feet naked in the mud of our pueblos, oozing up between my toes because there has been so much rain. And I smelled the smells of what it smells like when rain pelts the walls of our Pueblo village. He said, I felt the feeling of what it feels like to run naked through chest-high fields of corn because there's been so much rain. And he said, in that moment, I knew that I had communed with the forces of creation. And from that point forward, he said, my prayer becomes a prayer of thanks. And I said, do you mean thanks for what you've created? And he said, no, and he looked at me again, and this was so important. And now quantum science is bearing out what he's saying. He said, no, I didn't give thanks for what we've created because we never create anything. He said, all possibilities are already created. They are sleeping until we awaken them through the choices that we make in our lives, through the choice of feeling that we have in our lives. So what he was saying was he didn't create the rain. He had the feeling of what it feels like to be in the presence of rain, and in that way, through the language of human feeling, called that possibility to bear upon our world. And this, I have not been to the kiva that you were just describing. I'm very interested to hear what you're sharing, Laura Lee, because it does make a lot of sense that they would surround themselves with the images that evoke the feeling of what that rain is like. On the one hand, and then on the other hand, how in the world would you ever convey that through the written language? How would you leave that, and then you take that idea one step further, how would you leave that to a people who would not even exist in your world for another 2,500 years.
Well, who's to say they were writing for us? They were probably writing for themselves, and it's up to us to decode it.
And some, I believe that they were. Isaiah, however, was very clear. He was writing to those who would live in his future. And he was so clear about it that he said something. It's the only time I've ever seen this written in an ancient text. He wrote to us, and he said he anticipated us not understanding what he wrote. And to paraphrase what he was saying, he says, when these scrolls are given to someone and they are invited to read them, the people will respond by saying, I can read the scrolls, but I cannot read what has been sealed. So I believe what he's saying is we can read the words, we can translate the letters day in and day out, but whether or not we understand what they're saying or not is dependent upon the context of what we have come to know as our life experience. So without understanding quantum science now says that for every moment in our lives, many, many, many possibilities all exist simultaneously, just like Isaiah was saying to us, and he detailed them in the Isaiah text. What quantum science does not know at this point, however, is how we awaken specific possibilities, how we determine whether or not as a nation or as a globe we move into a 21st century of peace or one of chaos and destruction. Isaiah says that we do it by assuming the consciousness, the feeling of what it is that we choose as we become peace, compassion, understanding, forgiveness. In our daily lives, all of our little choices merge into the collective response for this time in history, and we will find ourselves on that path of global peace. And it makes a lot of sense.
It does. So I've heard of other visualization techniques where they say, put your senses into it. I read a book, my mother had a book, ages ago when I was in, like, junior high, trying to play tennis, you know, do my tennis lessons, and I was getting frustrated. And she said, well, here's an interesting book called Psycho-Cybernetics, some really old book. And I'm reading this, and it talks about if you want to make the perfect golf swing, it was using golf as the example, then visualize the perfect swing. Let your brain lay down the neurological pathways in order to get the body to actually do that. Visualize it. See yourself there. I translated this to the tennis court. See yourself making the perfect swing. You know, get the body tuned to it so that it, the moment you'd want to do it, it goes on automatic pilot. So I saw that as a way of laying down those neurological pathways. If you're trying to play the piano, it's so frustrating at first. You've got to just keep at it and at it and at it until, you know, the one faint line in the neurological pathway to make your body do it becomes, you know, a crevice, you know, becomes a highway, a super highway, then bingo, it all kind of happens for you. But also, you know, I've heard other techniques, put your senses into it, whatever it is that you want to do or accomplish, smell it, taste it, see it, evoke all the senses. That and another correlation I want to make here to emotion and how we... Coming up soon with Greg Braden, we come back to talk more about the Isaiah effect. The radio bookstore has it at 800-243-1438. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.
All interviews on The Laura Lee Show are available on audio cassette. For information, call 1-800-243-1438. As you enjoy the guests, topics, discussions here on The Laura Lee Show, you'll want to know what's coming up next week. Each week, the upcoming guests and topics are sent out to thousands of subscribers of Laura Lee E-News. Laura Lee E-News is a weekly email newsletter, and you'll receive the latest tidbits, breaking news, and descriptions of scheduled topics. Laura Lee E-News. To subscribe, visit our website at www.lauralee.com or mail us with the word subscribe in the subject box. Our email address is lauralee@lauralee.com. Laura Lee E-News is received by subscription only, and you may unsubscribe at any time. Laura Lee E-News. www.lauralee.com.
The Radio Bookstore staff is here all week to fulfill your requests for Laura Lee Show audio tapes and the books and videos of many of the researchers you meet here. Call us at 1-800-243-1438 anytime, 24 hours a day, and receive a free catalog. Or write to us, The Radio Bookstore, P.O. Box 3010, Bellevue, Washington, 98009. And be sure to visit us at the Laura Lee Show homepage, www.lauralee.com.
In the early 19th century, Michael Faraday discovered how to transform mechanical energy into continuous electrical energy by moving electrical conductors through magnetic fields. Faraday called his invention the dynamo. And today we have the Dynamo hand-powered flashlight based on this discovery. In addition to its practical use as a flashlight, it's also a science toy in which you can watch electricity being created by its spinning magnets and whirling gears. And best of all, because this flashlight works without batteries, it works every time. Just squeeze the handle to get the gears moving, electricity is generated, and you've got light. Perfect for your car, home, or as a unique gift. Order today for only $13.95. Call 1-800-243-1438.
Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. We continue our conversation with Greg Braden. In addition to his earlier books, Awakening to Zero Point and Walking Between the Worlds, his third book, The Isaiah Effect, is just out, Decoding the Lost Science of Prayer and Prophecy. Purchase of this book through the Radio Bookstore comes with a free cassette of this conversation. If you'd like to give them a call at 800-243-1438. Some sort of discount off the cover price as well. And in addition, Greg has a number of videos and books on cassette and many more products if you'd like to look up his whole body of work. Give the Radio Bookstore a call. A couple of things, Greg. Back to using emotion as well as focused thought to as part of the prayer. I think there's a lot to be said for visualizing one's future on a collective sense. Then I have a couple more questions to ask you, but teasing parts of this out, first, a couple of things. Emotions seem to be a ready conduit for attracting things into your life or for opening up ESP communication. There's so many stories of people who don't consider themselves psychic who suddenly know when their grandmother died or suddenly know when their a loved one is in trouble and they get that intuition. Or my sister when she was having her baby. I mean, all of us in the family called my mother at the same exact moment going, oh, DeJune is, you know, everybody knew. You know, so if it's an emotional thing, you get the message more ready. So I think the emotions are a ready conduit for this through the ethers, through the consciousness kind of information. So that makes sense that you would use the emotion to activate that.
Well, it's the emotion that empowers the visualization. If the visualization is simply a thought, if you're just looking at the picture...
It doesn't have the oomph, does it?
Precisely. This is why for so many people, back in the, I don't know, the 70s and in the mid to early 80s, I guess, early to mid 80s, when affirmations were very popular. And, you know, I know you would see this as much as I did. People would do a bajillion affirmations every day. They'd have them on post-it notes on their bathroom mirror, on the dashboard,
for a while,
the mirrors, on their CRTs at work, and it would say, "My perfect mate is manifesting for me now," you know, or "I am rich and abundant in all ways." They would say this to themselves a bajillion times a day, and I had friends that did this religiously, Laura Lee, and for many people, the affirmations simply did not work. And I spoke with people who had that experience, and what I found was, for the ones where it did not work, more often than not, they were saying the words on the one hand, so that was the thought. On the other hand, the feeling they had from within did not match those words. In other words, people who said, "My perfect mate is manifesting for me now," as the thought, they had this feeling inside that maybe they weren't even worthy of sharing the beauty in this world with another person. So there was nothing to empower, nothing to give life, to breathe life into the visualization. This is so So now we can actually create a definition. When we have a visualization without emotion, that's what we call a wish. The wish is the thought. When we have the visualization empowered with the emotion, it becomes a prayer. Mm-hmm. And that's what opens the door to the possibility. And to get back to the answer question you asked just before the break, now we can apply this to the fires in Peru in 1998 as a result of the El Nino weather effects. Portions of Peru were extremely wet and some were extremely dry. In the mountains around Machu Picchu, one of the most sacred sites certainly in the world and one of the key economic sites to the Peruvian people.
For tourism.
For tourism, lightning fires or lightning ignited fires in the jungles around Machu Picchu in 1998. It is so remote they could not get equipment up to douse these fires. And when the wind shifted, it was almost certain that Machu Picchu would be destroyed. And the fires, in fact, scorched the edges of Machu Picchu. When all the technology failed, when the helicopters couldn't drop the water, when the chemicals didn't arrive, when the weather was, or the heat was so bad they couldn't get the equipment in, the villages returned to something that they had always done in the past as a last resort. They returned to a mode of collective, or what we call mass prayer. And within hours of the prayers, weather patterns shifted, a low-pressure system came in, clouds developed, and the rains doused those fires and saved Machu Picchu. And it's not that they imposed their will, it's that they made a choice of having that rain there rather than feeling helpless and powerless in the presence of the fires.
Hmm.
So as a scientist, I have to say, we're hard-pressed to measure these things on the one hand. On the other hand, the correlations are so high, we must say that there is an effect.
With all of the kind of fear going on today, oh, World War III is around the corner, oh, global warming, we're going to burn up, oh, the next ice age is around the corner, oh, you know, the forces of darkness descending, oh, we're in the depths of the Kali Yuga. You know, there's a lot of fear going on out there. You don't want to be Pollyanna, but you want to look at the world's problems in the eye. Overpopulation, for example. I mean, it's a reality. So isn't the fear on the one hand kind of disempowering people, bringing those future possibilities more onto into manifestation?
Well,
what's the solution?
Well, certainly
collective prayer groups to, you know, visualize peace. We can all put down, you know, the military-industrial complex's bevy of weapons. They won't go off. You know, the rains will come on time.
If we think back to the example that I gave of my Native American friend praying rain, when he blessed and gave thanks for the drought that had been, he released that and opened up the door for something new to come in. If he had been angry at the drought, that anger is what would have held,
it's an emotion.
In his belief, would mm-hmm. have held that power in place and actually empowered the very thing that he was praying to change. So that same concept may apply on a larger scale to what we're saying. And clearly, researchers and scientists throughout the world are stating in the open literature, Laura Lee, they're saying that we as humankind, as a planet, are about to face the greatest challenges ever known to humankind in the next 10 to 12 years that may, in fact, even determine whether or not we will survive this time in history, this time in civilization. With many regional weather patterns merging together in what are believed to be super storms, with new strains of virus that our chemicals don't know what to do with, we have no antibiotics and no vaccinations against. So what we say from the perspective of what Isaiah and many ancient traditions are saying to us is that these scenarios and the ones you described, they are certainly possible, and they are one of many, many, many possibilities that quantum science now agrees are there. Quantum science says for every experience that we would ever know, there are many possibilities playing out for that experience.
Well, I think mathematicians like the equation that suggests there are 21 dimensions or possibly parallel universes because it makes certain unified field theory equations play out better or something.
Well,
they're
struggling to find the mathematics to describe this precisely. Albert Einstein was perhaps one of the first. What he said was that the past and the present First, he said, time is not at all what it seems. That was a direct quote.
And Fred Allen Wolf suggests that the timeline moves both ways. We can affect the past as much as we can affect the future.
Yeah, and that's what Einstein said. The past and the future exist at the same time. They're simultaneous. Stephen Hawking now takes this one step further and says that for every moment in time, we cannot say what the outcome of that moment will be. What we can do is give percentages of probabilities for what that outcome will be. So what we're saying is as mass consciousness shifts through the use of prayer, what we're doing is tipping the scale of the probabilities toward an outcome of peace, understanding, compassion in our world rather than the destruction and the ravages of war and famine.
Your friend who asked you to accompany him on a prayer for rain, you said he wasn't praying for the creation of the rain because that creation already existed. Everything already exists. They're all sleeping, and he was awakening it. What then in his final prayer of thanks was he giving thanks for?
He was giving thanks for his opportunity to choose.
Ah.
For the opportunity to choose. He was honoring the creative forces that have given him the opportunity to choose again. It's so subtle, and, you know, honestly, I know as a scientist, this is a very, very different way of thinking about things. And some people say, well, it's too simple. It couldn't possibly be that easy on the one hand. On the other hand, the correlations are so high between the times that people use this modality of prayer. This kind of prayer has no outward expression. There are no words. It's a consciousness that we embody so that we may be walking down the street or driving in our cars or having a meal or interacting with friends. Prayer is based in the feeling, as the Tibetans reminded us. So we may carry this feeling with us throughout our lives, and in that sense, life then becomes the prayer. And in that prayer, in the peace, the gratitude, and appreciation that we hold in our hearts, that then is what opens the door to events mirroring that in our outer world. We've done a lot of work with the HeartMath organization, Northern California, who are pioneers in understanding the relationship between the human heart, the human mind, the physiology in our bodies, and now the world beyond our bodies. One of the things they discovered back, five, 6 years ago, one of the fascinating studies was that one individual in nature, when they changed their emotions, an emotion of anger and rage and hate and jealousy, that emotion is registered in the leaves of trees up to 50 feet away, in the bark of the trees, in the electrical conductivity of the rocks in the soil. And when that person shifts from anger and rage to understanding and compassion, those changes are reflected as well, up to 50 feet away. Now they know that around every human heart there is a digitally measurable field between 5 and 8 feet in diameter. It's an electromagnetic field. This isn't an aura or a prana. It's essentially shaped as a tube torus. So we have these field effects that we're just beginning to understand. It appears that they are regulated through human emotion, human thought, and human feeling. And as we do that, we are, in essence, engineering an inner technology. And we're just beginning to understand the power that we have as we come together in mass prayer, mass choice, the power that that has to affect the world around us in very positive ways.
You know, Cleve Baxter, back in the, 70s, 80s, was conducting his, or assimilating all of the, no, he was the one conducting, that's right, in Secret Life of Plants by Peter Tompkins.
Oh, sure, sure.
They quote a lot of Cleve Baxter's experiments on how plants are picking up our emotional states. So that makes sense. But I didn't know about the rocks and the soil. But what you're suggesting is that there's a field of electrical conductivity that permeates the environment around us, and it's even present in the rocks and the soil.
Well, right now, Laura,
is this like morphogenetic, Rupert Sheldrake's morphogenic field, this kind of field of communication?
It may very well be. We are limited in understanding this field only by the ability of our machines, the machines that we've designed.
Right, because they're not sensitive enough to pick all this up.
Well, sure, our machines will pick up this field 5 to 8 feet around the human body on the one hand. On the other hand, researchers that I've spoken with feel very strongly on a quantum level that these effects radiate far, far, far miles beyond the individual. And where all this comes down to, you know, these are very esoteric, very nebulous concepts. They're interesting, they're fun to talk about. Where they become very practical for me, Laura Lee, is that the best minds of our time are telling us in the only way they know how that the technology we have built may fail us in the very near future as we're faced with perhaps the greatest challenges ever to cross the path of humankind.
That would be a blessing, because then we'd have to put down the training wheels and really get on the bike and ride, wouldn't we? Have to use the inner technology.
And at the same time, gentlemen such as Michael Cremo, I know that you've had on your program before, and other researchers, look into our past and say there's a good possibility that humankind has reached a pinnacle of technological sophistication at some remote point in our distant past, and we collapsed, the technology collapsed, because we failed to remember the inner technology and marry that with the outer technology. So I believe, and I'm very optimistic, that we will survive the great challenges of our time because of the power that lives within us and our willingness to evoke that power through love and compassion and understanding, and not just to survive, to transcend, to become more than the challenges of our time. And I think history will look to this generation and this time, and they'll say that's when the choice was made.
Well, Michael Cremo gives us a wonderful discourse on the Vedic timeline and how it looks like we're in the midst of the Kali Yuga, but having a little window of Golden Age within the Dark Age. And he says that the Kali Yuga is characterized by technology and violence.
Oh, interesting.
And you could say that's exactly what our time is all about. We're relying on technology and we're very violent. And it seems to me that we have two choices. Either our technology will extend forward to the point where it will begin mapping out this unseen, the quantum level, the consciousness will be put back into the equation. And once we understand, oh, gee, we don't need all of this hardware. We've really got software within us that can do this all, and so the hardware will look less attractive and we'll start turning on the inner technology. That's one possibility, the way I see it. Or the second is, what you're describing is that the technology will fail, or it'll, you know, artificial intelligence will threaten to take over the machines, like in The Matrix or something, or we'll blow it up or something. So then we'll have to rely on the inner technology as just a fail-safe mechanism. But either way, I think we'll get there again.
Well, I believe we will. I was on a very interesting panel at a conference in Santa Fe, New Mexico, this last weekend with one of the Apollo astronauts, Edgar Mitchell, and we were on a discussion panel together at this conference, and he was saying precisely the same thing. From his perspective, he is one of the few people, actually the only person I've ever spoken to that can begin a conversation by saying, when we return from the moon, this happened to us. And it was in the absence of Earth's magnetic fields and being out in space looking back at the Earth that he and other astronauts as well felt these tremendous shifts in their understandings of the relationship between us and our world and the great possibilities that live within each of us and how those may be married and mirrored in the way that we engineer and build our world. The machines are wonderful, and we have the opportunity now to, rather than giving our power away to the machines, to allow them to serve us. So as we find ourselves faced with extremes in weather and natural phenomena that appear to us not to make any sense, the ancient traditions come back time and time again. They say those patterns are mirrors of the chaos in human consciousness. As we change what's happening in our perceptions and our beliefs, we may expect to see those patterns change and become much less threatening. So it may be less about going out and imposing the change in our world, and again, what so many people have said about creating the change within our bodies, within the way we conduct our lives in the presence of one another, and knowing that change will be mirrored in the natural forces of our world. And again, it's a very different way of looking at our role in creation.
Well, One of the questions I was trying to bring up earlier was, it's one thing to map out future possibilities for oneself. It's another to participate in a collective one. What's the leap there? How does it work? And if you're describing a 50-foot field or a much further field, you know, every action goes out into space and, you know, infinitely, and then we are living in a sea of actions and interactions and this field extending all of these, you know, sea of energy and fields, one can visualize. And then that would explain a lot of things. That would explain ESP. That would explain effects at a distance and how these things are communicated. That would explain the passing of ideas simultaneously without direct cause and effect, seemingly. I mean, it explains so much, and how we're all on the collective stage together, all reading and writing our lines at the same time and affecting one another, though we don't see it directly. So it seems to me that as we're continuing to map out this unseen, we'll be mapping out this turf, and we'll begin to see these relationships, these cause and effects become apparent to us.
I believe this is what will bring at last the chasm that has traditionally existed between science and religion, or perhaps more accurately, science and spiritual traditions. We'll bring them together, because what we're finding, we've reached a point now where science, in many instances, is looking to religion to explain what it cannot, and religion is looking to science to explain what it cannot. Perhaps one of the most telling quotes, and I talk about this in the new book, Max Planck, the physicist that worked with our development of nuclear bomb during the war, when he accepted his Nobel Prize, he said a very interesting thing for scientists. He says, as a scientist who has studied matter all of my life, I can tell you that there is no matter as such, that our world is made up of minute solar systems of waves, and he said, behind these waves, we must assume there is an intelligence or a mind, and we call that mind God. So for him to say something like that as a physicist was, and I'm paraphrasing, that wasn't exactly what he said. It was very, very close. So I think what's happening is that spirituality has had these understandings and has described it in one language. Science is simply another language. Mathematics is simply another language, and that language is now catching up. And I believe we're moving toward a convergence point, where we look at one another and say, you know, we've been talking about the same thing using very different language. And the moment we do that, that's the birth of the new wisdom that transcends science and religion and mysticism. It carries us into new heights with an understanding we don't even have a name for yet. I think it's very exciting, very exciting.
Isn't it? And so in terms of tips, how do we begin to apply this in our own lives? How do we begin to harness this proper mode of prayer? We start out in small ways, and we'll soon graduate to bigger ways.
Well, this is
of employing this.
Certainly, this is, I think, the value of the Isaiah effect, and these traditions may be practiced personally, or as we come together collectively in mass prayer with millions of people around the world, coordinated through the World Wide Web, or as individuals in our daily life. What Isaiah is saying to us, and very clearly in his words, and so many other traditions were saying in the language of their time, is that the way that we conduct ourselves in the presence of one another in our daily lives, in those seemingly insignificant moments at the dinner table with family, between husbands and wives and children, and with the cashier at the checkout counter, on the freeways, those little seemingly insignificant moments are actually the elements that all merge together into the collective answer for this time in history. So it does no good for us to sit down at night and pray peace if during the day we are enraged and frustrated throughout our day.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're invited to do is to honor all life, to find that peace in our hearts. Now the research shows that when we do that, the peace in our hearts actually gives life to our bodies. It embodies, the peace in our hearts actually turns on the DHEA hormones. It enables our immune system within our bodies, and now the effects are felt beyond our body as our world mirrors peace back to us. And peace comes about in many different ways. So it's about honoring one another, honoring all life, and redefining the experiences of our lives so that they serve us rather than take our lives, deny us life.
Is it fun to realize that the world is so much more than we originally thought it, that there's a whole new rule book to follow that really makes so much sense and that empowers one? It seems to me the ancient mindset was about participation in creation. And it seems our modern mindset feels that we participate on the WYSIWYG level, the what you see is what you get level. And, you know, there's ways you can cheat your way around that. You know, drop some coins in at the thing at church and you'll be absolved. Go to confession and you're absolved. It's a little bit more challenging than that.
Drop a pill and you're healed. It's the same thing.
Exactly.
Well, it is. And this is, again, we come back. This is what was lost. People ask me so often, they say, why would you be so concerned about texts that were lost 1,700 years ago when we have this technology today? We've got the internet. We put people on the moon.
People ask you that?
And they do. And I understand why they're saying what they're saying. Yes, we have that technology, and much of our science was developed based on understandings of how we relate to one another, to this world, and to the cosmos. We have never explored the relationship of the unseen forces of human emotion because they were negated 1,700 years ago. So it forced us onto this path where we explored the linear and the left brain and the logic of our world, and now we have developed that to such a point to come full circle. We're invited to come back into the inner technology of the human emotion, and I believe what may force us onto that path is precisely what we stated. When we are faced with challenges that our technology cannot address, just like the people in those villages in Peru, perhaps as a last resort, when everything else fails, we'll go back to what we've always known and in that way redefine and reassure our role in participating in creation.
Now, Greg, you've resolved a lot of your stuff so that you go around and you're not emitting rage and all of that. Do you also sit down on a daily basis and say, okay, for the next minute, I'm going to visualize the possibilities for the world or for myself that I want to help select? Do you have a focus time? It doesn't take a long time, right, to call up those emotions. But do you have a set time that you do it, or are you practicing it kind of in a sense all the time?
What I've always done since the earliest time I can remember, Laura Lee, is the last thing before I sleep at night, I examine the day and give thanks for the day that has just been and for the day that is yet to be and for the opportunities that crossed my path on the day that has just been, for those that I recognized, I embrace them, and for those that I did not recognize, I release them in compassion so that I can recognize them when they come around again. Having done that, I also recognize the holographic principles. As I find peace in my personal world, I know that the whole benefits from that. And yes, I do pray peace for our world and give thanks for the peace that already exists in our world, asking for greater and greater, or acknowledging greater and greater amounts of that peace. I do that on a daily basis, and through this mode of prayer, the prayer becomes our lives. So to the degree that I'm capable, I carry this prayer with me in everything that I do, each moment of my waking life, my waking hours, as well as when I sleep at night, to the degree that I'm capable. Now I'm still learning.
Thanks so much, Greg. Appreciate your time today. And any last comments?
Well, I would just like to say, Laura Lee, thank you for once again being such a gracious host and for the opportunity to share this wonderful new format in the on the World Wide Web, and for your patience and your skills as an interviewer. It's always a joy to share this time together, and it goes by so quickly.
Thanks for all your good work, and happy trails on your travels. And I want to recommend again Greg's third book just out, The Isaiah Effect, Decoding the Lost Science of Prayer and Prophecy. And if you haven't read them yet, do pick up Awakening to Zero Point and Walking Between the Worlds. That was Greg Braden. And this has been Conversation for Exploration. Hope you join us next time. I'm Laura Lee. And hello there. I'm Laura Lee, and I want to thank you for tuning in tonight. Mike Mandeville is back. He's the guy that has been looking through the Edgar